My process is purely logistical. If I'm effective, it's because of one simple fact. I don't give a fuck.
All right, turn it over, rock and roll. Okay, everybody, welcome into another edition of the podcast where Matt and Bob were here to pod about David Fincher's The Killer, now streaming on Netflix. You're listening to the Analysis. Bob, it's been a while, man. You were a guest in my home. We saw a Lions victory at SoFi. It was a great time, man. I'm excited to be in a lucid state with you. And reviewing a movie we saw while you were here.
I am a human and I need to be loved, just like something in a something song.
Yeah, new appreciation for the Smiths after this movie. Lot of those.
What movie did more for the Smiths, this or 500 Days of Summer?
Oh God! Well, that's the other movie I was thinking about, where she goes like.
They get
to
in the
die
elevator.
By your side, what a heavenly way to die. And then she's like, I love that song. And then of course he's like, oh my, I love that song too.
Yeah, I think he goes shit as the doors are closing because he knows he just fell in love with her.
Yeah.
It's a pretty cool little moment, actually.
Great movie. But yeah, but this same sort of thing where I didn't really get the jokes about when he's firing up the song titles, because I don't know the Smiths that well, but something about putting a girlfriend in a body bag while he's like lugging a corpse around. Anyway, we're jumping the gun. We're talking about The Killer. David Fincher's 12th film came out in theaters briefly and then dropped on Netflix to be forgotten about instantly. Who knows what the metrics are or how people are viewing this or. I haven't really gotten any talk about it apart from me and you, but what were your reactions? I mean, you've since seen it a second time, right?
Yeah, so me and you watched it. I was not of sober mind, as you asked, are you in a lucid state right now? I was not in a lucid state when we were watching it. And so I was coming in and out of it. I was kind of dozing off. And I was kind of watching it, but not actively, and you would laugh at a bit, or you'd be like, ah, see, I like that move, and I would refocus and be like, oh shit, I just missed like 15 minutes, just not being present in my own body. So after we got done with the movie, my first thoughts were, that was a slower burn than I thought it was going to be. It wasn't the same kind of thrill ride that I was anticipating. Fincher's this like thrilling director typically.
It's not Seven, it's not Fight Club. It's more methodical, precise. Yes.
Yeah, and my second thought was, this is very similar to a few movies that I've liked, but this movie didn't stand out to me as something. I was curious as to like why Fincher wanted to do this particular story in this particular type of narrative, because it reminded me of Drive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it reminded me of The American. Remember the George Clooney movie? It was another very slow burn. You Were Never Really Here, which was the Joaquin Phoenix movie.
Okay, yeah.
And then I got like threads of Collateral in it, as well as Equilibrium, and it kind of this whole ice cold killer, and they've got these methodical processes, and then something goes wrong. Or The Professional was another one I was thinking about, where something gets introduced into their process and their kind of distance they put themselves between empathy or vulnerability to be able to do their jobs starts to change, and then they change as a person, and obviously they have a different world approach towards the end. Like that's that, all of those movies have that exact type of narrative, and this one was similar. So I was kind of like, I didn't hate it, but I was also like, why was this something Fincher felt like he needed to do?
What's interesting is that the author or the screenwriter, Andrew Kevin Walker. He wrote Seven, and he moved to California to sell the script, partners with David Fincher, obviously, and then kind of slips into obscurity and doesn't really do anything until this movie. I guess he did some polishes. I was just reading about this guy. He wrote Sleepy Hollow for Tim Burton. But then a bunch of other stuff, 8mm, he had to disown.
Movie sucked.
He kind of came in and did, some, I guess, rewrites uncredited on some Fincher movies, but like he hasn't penned a script since Seven, which I just find interesting. Cause like, I was like, oh, he wrote Seven. I wonder if he wrote all of them. And obviously that's not true because Fincher's dad wrote Mank and, you know, whatever else, adaptations of this and that. But, I know this is an adaptation of like a graphic novel. And I think what you're asking is like, why did he want to do it? And I think, you know, 12 movies in, I think he's interested because he's, famously known as a guy that is very methodical, precise, multiple takes, hundreds of takes. Like, he kind of has this serial killer mentality, and you think about what he's interested in, these dark, brooding, like noir, masculine kind of movies about guys that are kind of on the outskirts of society or like skirting society. And at the same time, Fincher's a guy that has directed like Nike commercials and Gap, and he's kind of almost like this commercial whore, but then in his movies he's like anti-capitalism and consumerism, and it's like this really interesting like duality this guy has. But you know, you think about Zodiac, Seven, this, he's really into killers. And then he goes and does something like The Social Network, which might be his like most, his best movie. I mean, it's debatable.
Social Network is not debatable. That's 100% his best movie.
Oh, you have that over Fight Club, you think?
Yeah, I think so. Fight Club's awesome in a different way, but
super iconic.
14-year-old me, yeah, the 14-year-old me is going to pick Fight Club, but the adult me is like, oh, the better movie overall is Social Network.
In terms of what could have won something, like Social Network got robbed.
I mean, I'm not as worried about the Oscars, even though me and you read the Oscars War as I'm reading it now, but it's, I just think Fight Club's, They're both great movies. I think Seven's amazing. I still think about Seven. I was just talking with someone today that said it still lives in their mind from time to time when they're on long drives. Girl with the Dragon Tattoo deals with murders and killers. Gone Girl is just a psycho lady who's also a murderer and a killer. So yeah, there's a lot of murdering in all these movies besides Social Network. And I guess that's why it doesn't need a hook. It's just a great movie. It doesn't need this like kind of thrilling hook to it, and it's thrilling in its own way. I think also the partnership with him and
Michael Fassbender. Yeah, it just seems so obvious, right? Like, how have they not done this? How am I not in that movie? Just seems like I feel like they should have been like, God, it's like Leo and Scorsese. I feel like these two should be making movie after movie together. Obviously, Fassbender's been on a bit of a pause, but. Because it kind of reminds me of Shame, but then like the movie he did about the sex addict and kind of the look of that movie. But then you do like The American, like his character in Shame, but in place of a more, you know, charming Mike, you know, George Clooney, right? But I really love the partnership, and it's 1 hour and 58 minutes. You know, we talked about this at dinner a little bit where. It's just this cool, slick movie where he kind of gets to show off.
Yeah.
It's like a movie about a guy who's methodical, shot by a guy who's methodical. But then it's like so darkly dry and funny. Where like this guy is so regimented, but he keeps fucking up.
Body, like he, 180-pound male, middle-aged, non-smoker. This should take about 8 minutes.
Yeah, all right. I got 6 minutes to interview this, or interview this guy.
To get this, to get dirt on this guy. Oh fuck!
It's like a South Park death.
Oh shit! Yeah.
Oh. And then, and he's like, oh, I'd be batting 1,000, but I refuse to take credit for this, McDonald's and smoking.
Cardiac arrest, and marital stress.
It reminded me of like certain improv teachings where it's like people tap on the glass to see the fish move. Like if you introduce a character, we need to have it be at his most interesting moment. So this guy's been crushing it for years or whatever. He's the best in the business. And then, but when we dive in, it's like, oh, this is when he fucks up. And then, so, but it was just kind of funny to see his rationale unravel. Cause it's wall to wall voiceover. This guy, his process and technique and his mantras. But everything he's saying isn't really what's happening on the screen.
Well, and I think that shows you the growth of the character, though. I mean, he says all the time empathy is weakness, but it's really empathy that takes him on his journey. Him promising that brother that he's going to protect the girl that he's seeing. Mm-hmm. That's empathy. And even getting to when he has the showdown with Clyborne at the end and he decides to spare him, that's the whole journey. So you don't get that unless you're hearing the inner monologue. Yeah, and then he talks about how the few have always exploited the many, and he looks at himself as the few and the few. And then his last line at the end of the movie is, you could be one of the many like me. And he's sitting in that lawn chair, you know? So it's like, with that, you get context and you see the character arc.
It is kind of cool. Like, he's so nihilistic, right? And everything is so cut black and white. Like, skepticism is often mistaken for cynicism. Yeah. But then he's like dating some chick in the Dominican Republic and like has a home with her and is in love and is desperate, unravels when she's beaten up. It just kind of flies in the face of everything this guy is telling us, which is so cool because like this unreliable narrator, but you never leave his perspective. So then it's like you don't really know what's real or what to believe in, because the word of God is this guy who is kind of swerving. So yeah. I found that like super interesting, and it like apart from the whole character development and the arc of this guy, and we can kind of break down the plot in a second here, but I just think kind of the complete control over an audience's emotions and kind of being able to play us like a piano where this moment is exciting, but then I'm going to pull you back. A lot of that had to do with the sound design, which, you said earlier, like when you rewatched it, I think that was more clear to you, right?
Well, yeah, I want you to walk the listeners through what you had kind of walked me through when we were talking about it over dinner, and that especially that first sequence where I like the build, and the first act was my favorite act, favorite part of the movie. But you watch him, and Fassbender is so great physically. He almost kind of like moves like a ballet dancer. Like he should have been in Black Swan almost.
Yeah.
And he's doing those. It's funny because he wakes up cold, or he's cold like literally and figuratively, right? Like he's this cold-blooded killer, but he's also like next to a space heater. And I remember you got that was what got you to laugh the first time, was the space heater. You're like, oh, he's like cold in every way. And then you watch him kind of go through this boring process, and you can't be bored. If you have trouble with boredom, you can't do this gig. And then all of a sudden the lights light up, and you start to get the Smith song when he plugs the music in. And but you were really telling me eloquently like how the music takes you in and out, like it constantly keeps shifting, like almost like his focus in the moment keeps shifting. And once I kind of focused on that the second watch, I was like, oh, this is creative.
Yeah, well, it's just upending the viewer's expectations, because when you're watching that scene, and I was reminded of in Skyfall where he's observing that assassin, and then Daniel Craig has to take out that assassin, and it's shot gorgeously. Roger Deakins, I think they're in Macau or somewhere else, but they and then they have that really cool fight sequence where it's all mirrored, and then and like the music is bumping, and it's just like but here you're like, okay, here we go, like a cool kill shot, and then like the music crescendos, but no, we're pulled back into his earpiece.
Yeah, because he's got to go to he crosses the room or something that Mark does,
and then it's just like almost subconsciously you're like, man, I'm kind of been almost indoctrinated to expect this in a movie where when the music crescendos, I get to see something cool. And then this, he pulls it back and he's almost like, I know what you want to see, you sick fuck, but I'm going to do something different. And it's not about getting to see a cool death. It's about going into this guy's head and kind of what we're listening to. But when I take the camera out and we see him, we're no longer in his perspective. So then we only hear it kind of as a third party through his headphones. But then when the camera is on the mark and then you're kind of inside his brain when like the music is all encompassing, I thought that was just such a cool way to put the audience in the moment and just to kind of like almost play us for fools.
Yeah, I agree. I think, and when you watch it with that perspective the second time, that's when you start appreciating those directorial choices.
The craft and like the editing and like everything is so precise and a choice. And
yeah,
when you're able to kind of notice little things like that, you realize how much you're missing the rest of the movie. Probably just every little thing is considered.
You kind of have to earn the right as a filmmaker to have some of those moments, right? Like Scorsese earns the right to do a 4-hour living room drama, right. like Killers of the Flower Moon. And Fincher earns the right to kind of have an hour and 45 minute slow burn character study where we're going to use creative techniques subconsciously to inform you about my character.
Yeah.
And it's just like you. If this was his first movie, he's probably not going to, it's
a little
going
too subtle.
To get lost. Yeah. But you know, because he's had the career he's had, he earns that opportunity. Another nice, bit of storytelling that happened. And I noticed this the second time I watched it was the use of his watch and the heartbeat rate on his watch.
Yeah.
And I thought that was pretty cool. It was a nice device to show you how even how out of his comfort zone he is once he's in the kind of like second stages of the movie, and where he's trying to get to the airport and he sees the guard dog, and all of a sudden the watch starts going off, so he's got to bail out of line and all that stuff. And it reminded me a lot of, do you remember the Ad Astra movie with Brad Pitt?
Yeah, Sad Brad Astra.
But they would always, you were always hearing his heart monitor over the computer.
PA. Yeah. Okay.
And like it was always talking about. And so like, as the movie's going along, he gets more and more stressed. He has a hard time getting his resting heart rate down. And that was happening here too. So it was like those things. And that wasn't in the monologue. He's not saying that outright, but just little pieces of storytelling that you're like, okay, this is pretty cool.
Yeah, there are little moments where, because it's so chapter oriented, right? There's the, chapter
each
one.
Each chapter is a different death.
Yeah, and then he has to. spoiler free or spoiler heavy from here on out? But yeah, so this guy, this like badass killer, fucks up a hit, and then he's got to kind of clean up the mess. So he runs home to his safe house, Dominican Republic or wherever it is, Colombia. The girl he's been seeing has been beat up for information. The fact that she wasn't killed and disappeared kind of was interesting or confusing, I think. Because then
I just jumped out the window and I hid in the woods. Like, really, these are. Like
trained killers,
professional killers at the highest level, and you just kind of hid in the woods. Cool. All right.
Did it have anything to do with the fact that he took so long getting back because he was so paranoid about being followed, that had he gone straight back there, he would have intercepted these guys? So maybe they saw him coming or knew he was on his way. So the subcontractors had, but so you send down like kind of an elite expert, the Tilda Swinton character, along with this brooding brute guy to like, you need two
from
people.
Miami.
Yeah, yeah. I think maybe they were expecting him to be there. Although even, and then
that's
his handler's like, I can't believe you went home. Like you fucked up. You're supposed to disappear. Just the fact that I don't understand sending two killers and then not even, and then letting the girl break free after you beat her up. And I found that a little muddy, but then once he's on the trail, you know, it's pretty cool. And, you know, we're back to him and, you know, Hodges or whatever, his handler, who was played by Charles Parnell, who was in Top Gun Maverick, Bob. I'm not sure you caught that.
There it goes. Sound the siren.
Did you have a favorite of those kills? Because I think me and you are both in agreement. It was the,
chapter one to me, but the anti-kill, which I like that. I like the fact that he works in a WeWork, which is kind of an omen. It's like company that's.
I think that's going that down. Company declares bankruptcy like the day after I saw that, and like because this was released for a few weeks in theaters, or it premiered at Venice Festival. But I think WeWork is recently.
Oh, it's very
declared,
deliberate that he's at a WeWork. Yeah. And it's kind of this like sad, like decaying company, and he's a sad, lonely company, and he's this sad, lonely man. But
well, then
anyway,
he gets sustenance at McDonald's because there's 1,600 locations or whatever in France, and then it's the cheapest way to get protein. He says something about Starbucks as well.
Yeah, there's probably some, and like you said, Fincher's always commenting on commercialism and consumerism. But I think the best of the actual kills, I appreciated it was almost like the John Wick hand-to-hand fight with the brute. I thought that definitely wakes you up. And I've heard a few people that like checked this out and they were like, oh, I fell asleep. Like, it's, yeah, I was didn't keep my interest. And I can't blame them for that. But I thought that hand-to-hand combat scene was really badass.
Very John Wick. And then even than that, they sneak some humor in where he's like hiding behind the counter and he like reaches up to get some sort of a weapon or a knife. And he gets like a cheese grater. And then you're like, okay, we're going to see him do something cool with a cheese grater. And he's like, ah, fuck. And then he just tosses it. But then that distracts the guy. So he's able to kind of get the jump on him. But
yeah, I thought that was pretty good.
As opposed to John Wick using that cheese grater.
Song. Yeah. John uses the cheese grater and he like gets it in the guy's nose or something. Like that. Yeah. So he just tosses it as a distraction, sprints to the other side. Yeah. So that was great.
I just enjoyed the constant upending of expectations. Like, here we go, the John Wick scene. And then you still kind of have this irreverent humor in there. But yeah, you were saying the...
Well, the Tilda Swinton scene, particularly the bear story. And I thought that was pretty well done. And also...
Did they have to pay you for the use of that story about you getting fucked by a bear in the woods?
Yeah, they did come and they talked to me about that, about the woods, how I was sodomized by that bear all the time, but I kept going back into the woods.
You know,
you're not here for the hunt.
That was the most interesting sort of what is this guy's character, because you know, he tracks down this woman who was sent to clean up his mess, so kind of like the contract killer for the contract killer, so the expert, as the chapter is called, but she's like living it up, kind of in a nice house, upstate New York, kind of off the Hudson River or whatever, Hyde Park, and then she's going to fancy restaurants. Looked like a Michelin star place. She has like her own scotch bottle like stored there. She's doing like a whiskey tasting. And this guy's like, what the fuck? I can't he sick. He sits down just because he's like intrigued. But meanwhile, this guy has like personal storage lockers all over the world. He's constantly living in fear. You know, he's got a nice ass house in Colombia, but like, you know, that's his little taste, and it's immediately blown up. Whereas I think I found that interesting. And he sits there in silence and lets her talk. But I mean, how did you feel about that sequence? Did it like inform the character for you at all? Or
I think at the end it's she's talking about the bear, saying it wasn't the hunt driving the hunter, but something else. And I think him making the choice to scrub himself clean and leave the hitmen industry is him realizing that, you know, he wants to stop the hunt. But you also, towards the end, you see that kind of like little twitch in his eye in the close up, and it's like, oh, he might inevitably know he's got to go back to the hunt, like the sodomy and like the hustle again. So that's, you know, at least what she's saying with that piece. And I liked the different ways that some of these characters tried to barter their way out of their fate. So you've got the cab driver who doesn't really know what he's getting himself into. He thinks he can talk his way out. And then you also had like Dolores, who just wanted to make it look good for the insurance company so her kid would get the insurance policy. And then you had this woman who almost, you'd think maybe she could have pulled it off, but, or maybe he had the drop on her whole time, but you know, she has kind of like a plot to get herself out in a creative way. So, I also
takes
just kind
of like
that.
Knife. Yeah.
She swipes the steak knife. Oh, I slipped. Can you help me up? You know?
Mm-hmm. I think he saw that coming from a mile away, but I think the most tender moment is like the Dolores character being like, I just took a bunch of Xanax. Just don't disappear me. And then, you know, actually, this was brought to my attention. The only moment we leave Michael Fassbender's perspective is when he leaves her alone in the car. And then we get that blood curdling scream, mm-hmm. and no one's around to help her at all, and she's like, fuck, this guy's gonna murder me. But because up until that point it's all kind of tongue-in-cheek and it's not real, you don't really get the terror from anybody. And that moment was kind of a cool choice to be like the only moment we go objective as opposed to subjective.
I did like the moment when he first goes in to the office with the trash can. He's on his way down, and that guy gets in, and he's like total Matt Hayes, and oh, you need help disposing that body? Just a little fucking cheesy fucker, and
yeah.
Fassbender's like, oh,
and then the person he's about to murder is like, bah,
ha. Yeah, help me, please.
The epilogue, like a 2-second epilogue, where it's just like he's like having a pina colada. I may need to, because you know, both, you know, that second time it was kind of like the weeds kicking in, and it's, you know, mm-hmm. we're falling asleep. But I don't really get that so much. I think up until that point, everything was so, considered and tight, and that felt a little tacked on. So I might need to revisit that moment. Yeah. But you know, it's like an SNL sketch. They're kind of hard to end.
How do you get out of here?
Right, but
Keenan needs to come in, Keenan Thompson, and say some bullshit at the end of it. Be like, "You killing on people? The what?
I like to say the critic consensus from Rotten Tomatoes here. The killer finds director David Fincher on firm footing with a stylish and engaging thriller that proves a perfect match for leading man Michael Fassbender. I mean,
yeah, I will
basically
say that.
What we've been saying, 86%. You know, it's a B plus, A minus, depending on your affinity for Fincher. And I thought it was super solid. I'm actually excited to see it again, just because like I just like the vibe and the, I guess, the almost the like the masterses, the master stroke, or the just the display of total control of someone's medium. That this is the best movie ever made, but like a guy almost showing off, where like a movie that could be very basic and is actually pretty cool. You know, in other hands, this would be so uninteresting. But I think, you know, he elevates it, which I think is a cool, example of that.
Yeah. I have, just a couple questions for you. First of all, if you had to have a soundtrack or a song that you would murder people to, what would your song be? Or you could pick a band, because he has multiple Smith songs that he kills to. So you going Blink-182?
I don't know if that would be appropriate for like keeping my heart rate down. You know what I mean? It's like,
okay,
you can't want to just start headbanging as you're like eyeing down the sights. Although having said that, you know, something like going away to college or I miss you, you know, kind of the more of the emo brooding.
Miss you.
I think.
Where are you?
Maybe some of like the Angels and Airwaves stuff a bit more. I don't know. That's a tough call. I mean, did you have anything pop out to you?
I do Death Cab for Cutie.
That's a
chill. That's vibes. A really,
or I mean Postal Service, that whole album.
Postal Service. Yeah. Something, you know, chilled just out.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, no, I've got a good one. And I played a few for you while we were driving around, but, The Midnight, the Days of Thunder album, a lot of sax solos. It's very atmospheric. You got like kind of the rain pouring down, kind of Blade Runner style. It's, I mean, something like a Blade Runner soundtrack as well, actually. It could be kind of cool.
There you go.
Great, like metallic wet. but yeah, I mean, a new appreciation for the Smiths. That I think it worked really well. And for people that really love the Smiths, there's some really funny kind of jokes in there, mostly due to like puns involving the, you know, the track listings. But I don't know. I thought it's a win for Netflix. It sucks that, you know, the guy that gave us Fight Club and Social Network and all these cool badass movies is, you know, his last two have gone straight to Netflix. Although I was just reminded of this, the you know like how we were talking about in Oppenheimer, how kind of creating the bomb of your own kind mm-hmm, of demise. Sure. You know, you had Christopher Nolan gave us Dark Knight, and then all of a sudden, the fact that David Fincher, who in collaboration with Netflix gave them House of Cards, which kind of allowed them to create this empire, is making a movie about a guy trying to take down his employers after kind of fucking up. It's kind of interesting how
a
these
little meta. I didn't think about this
going a little meta. A lot of these filmmakers are kind of railing against their creators in a way where, you know, Martin Scorsese, he needs like the Apple Plus, the Netflix money, Irishman, because Marvel is the only thing in theaters or was. So I just think it's kind of interesting that these
why he was drawn to this material. Maybe we'll bring it full circle.
There we go.
The only other question I had for you briefly here is why do you think he spares Clyburn at the end?
I think, yeah. So the guy that, because he's just a money man. There's nothing. I don't think, you know, in a way, even though he's like probably the most despicable arm or link in the chain, I think. The Fassbender's killer respects his success, and maybe he wants to work again. You know, I mean, this guy is pure business, so mm-hmm. you know he's not gonna come looking for him because he doesn't have. I mean, he's no longer connected to the arm of Implement. I don't know. I kind of want to rewatch that scene again because it doesn't seem like he would have any reason not to kind of close the loop.
It goes back to the bear though, right? Where it's like, I'm going by not killing you, I'm making an active choice to leave the hunt. And
right, well if that guy gets killed, I think actually there is a mention where, you know, you can take out some lawyer who's doubling as a
hitman or
yeah, right. But that you can't go and murder some fucking billionaire and hope things quiet down.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I mean, also the guy like didn't like legitimately. That's where he's like, do you not know why I'm here? Like, do you genuinely not know why I'm here? And I think it's he knows that guy had no active part. Everyone else that he kills has an active part in that event happening. The cab driver. Taking work home with him, the two killers, the lawyer's assistant, like all those people are in play. And this guy, although he was the money, didn't actually have any idea or make any decisions behind that happening.
Basically, it was like a risk-free guarantee offered with his purchase. He's like, hey, I ordered this kill. It went bad. Don't worry, sir. We'll take care of it. And then,
yeah, he didn't. He was like, I didn't have no idea what your boy was doing.
Yeah, so right.
He gets spared, but that also proves the empathy and that we were talking about that he claimed he didn't have, but he clearly does. So
yeah, but anyway,
I just wanted to see your thoughts on it.
No, but that's interesting because he goes to the trouble to get into this guy's living room. It's the stakeout and all the incredibly intense security. You know, he spends all that time getting up there, and then just to have a look at him and say. What? I mean, does he even make a point? He just kind of scares the guy, or I don't know. I guess I'm not sure why he went to the trouble, unless he was expecting to kill him and then had a moment of empathy.
Yeah, I think that's what it is.
I guess the point is that in meeting all these people, except maybe the brute, he kind of has a moment of like, maybe I could spare this person, but then. In kind of snapping Dolores's neck, that's kind of a little bit of empathy because, her son mm-hmm. will get the insurance money. So he's kind of maybe building up to the moment of letting this guy
who's right.
probably the least deserving, though. I mean, this fucking billionaire who's like ordering hits. Like, why does that guy get to live, But so, yeah, I think it's just the evolution of his character and maybe him becoming more and more human and. Entering society.
As he goes through those different chapters.
Yeah. Well, cool. Yeah. I mean, I thought it was a cool movie. It's I hope it doesn't get forgotten. And so you said it's mid-tier.
Yeah, I would put it. I mean, I think obviously it's after the Social Network. I would put it after
Zodiac. I got it right in the middle. I got it kind of at 7. So I went Fight Club, Social Network, interchange those. 7 in the top 3. You could make the case for Zodiac there, but Zodiac right after. The Game I love. That's one of my favorite single
Game's
like first viewings of a movie. It's one of those things where like I wish I could watch that movie for the first time again. Like nothing has like shocked that and Fight Club just like some of the greatest turns in like cinema history are these movies. And then I went Girl with the Dragon Tattoo right after that. Just like an incredibly cool adaptation. And then I went Killer. And then after that, you've got Mank, Gone Girl, Alien 3, which is cool, but like filled with problems and issues. And the studio took over Final Cut. Panic Room, pretty forgettable, but kind of cool. Kind of some nice kind of like movement of camera, whatever. But and then Benjamin Button just like seems I haven't rewatched that. I've only watched it once, but it seems like so out of
his
wheelhouse.
Time.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean it was still a good movie. I remember enjoying it when I saw it, but it's forgotten. I would still say it's probably better than this one, but I think you're a little low on Benjamin Button. But yeah, I mean, it's in the middle somewhere around Mank, and I think it's better than Panic Room, but somewhere in the kind of middle tier there.
Yeah, mix those up, however. All right, Walter, man, it was good to have you out here and put down a movie. I thought maybe we'd do the analysis on location, but the gummies.
We were too wasted the whole weekend, but that was by design. So we'll just do it. Just do it on Zoom like we always do. But yeah, man, thanks for having me out there and for always our rat-a-tats about the features.
Hell yeah. All right, man. We'll cut it.
Yeah, everybody. Thank you guys for listening. We're going to cut it there. Don't forget to smash the subscribe button. Smash it.
Smashed.
Feel free to leave us a review if you want. Treat each other with respect. And we'll see you down the road. Bye.